Education Committee will come to order. Welcome, colleagues, and I see we're going to be collecting some timeliness fines today.
Representative Roblin, I know...
He's out of town.
He's out of town. He had a meeting in the...
And Representative Farr squeaked in, so wouldn't you know. I was assessing you a fun fee.
Well, I have to say that the former mayor of Eugene walked me to this meeting. And he's pretty important. So.
One minute. We're chopped liver.
Representative, but we have important people in the audience.
There we go.
I offer my sincere apology.
And
we're talking about funding education first.
Okay, I'll give a dollar. I owe you.
There you go.
I don't have a dollar. I'll have to put my IOU in for right now.
Okay.
And just for the audience's information, we try to start our committee promptly so that we can respect those who are here to participate. We have a collection, we'll call it, what's the phrase out there now? It's not a tax, it's a revenue enhancement. you're aware with that. You're down with that, aren't you, Representative March?
You know, anything that John's for, I'm for.
Okay. Revenue enhancement for using acronyms without giving us the full explanation. For instance, U of O obviously means University of Oregon, but, you know, we just think it's helpful to have the explanation. That's a very simplified one. But there are some bureaucracies language that goes on in here, so we're trying to break that habit a little bit. And secondly, for cell phones. So if any of y'all have cell phones, we're collecting if they ring. Thank you. I see some movement to that. And certainly the timeliness issue. So with that... And don't think that I don't hear those acronyms. I'll nail you.
Madam Chair, okay. I realize we haven't designated what this money is for yet. It's for education.
Yeah, it's for education.
But you know, we might consider, just to put on the list, student leadership programs.
That's a wonderful idea. Since we have guests in the... Obviously from the your district, right?
No, but I play to the audience.
Vice Chair O'Connell.
I do not play to the audience, and I don't mind being mugged for student leadership.
There we go. Okay. Okay, well, that's on the list, at least. We can have a vote at the end of the session, I guess, where we're going to disperse those, but that would be very high on our list. Today we are having an informational hearing on a couple in a couple of areas, and the first presenter is President Dow from the Oregon Institute of Technology, also known as OIT. So if you'd like to come.
Thank you, Chair Flores and members of the committee. Martha Ann Dow, President of Oregon Institute of Technology. And I'd also like to introduce to you Denise Hansel, who is the Director of our Center for Health Professions at Oregon Institute of Technology. It's really a pleasure to have the opportunity to present to you today some solutions we feel to Oregon's healthcare workforce shortage in the area of education. We know that Oregon, as nationally, we have statistics that there is a critical shortage of healthcare workers, and we have over 100,000 healthcare professionals currently employed. We will probably need 48,000 healthcare workers by 2012. And we see a 20% growth projection in those years. The current outlook, of course, we hear mostly about nursing shortages, and the demand for registered nurses will exceed supply by over 22% by 2010. Most often we do zero in on the nursing health shortage, but I also want to call to your attention today the demand for allied health professionals in the other areas, medical and clinical lab, medical imaging, which includes radiology, sonography, nuclear medicine, other specialties, dental hygiene, and also, of course, physicians and MDs. Excuse me. We look at what has gone on in Oregon. We have an overarching need to target these employment areas. And as you can see in this slide, the employment column in 2010 and the projected growth in those areas listed for 2010, between 2000 and 2010. So a tremendous growth need, and the situation has come to looking at what are some of the factors that actually create the healthcare shortage. Of course, there's an aging population, increasing the demand for services. More healthcare workers are retiring as they approach my age and others. And the education programs have reached capacity, particularly in facilities, faculty and staff, and equipment. Sometimes skilled workers are leaving the healthcare areas because of the working conditions due to the fact that there is stress on the need for additional employees that are educated. Sometimes it's difficult to align the educational and training programs with the needs, current needs, and also with the mobility of the careers. And of course, in Oregon, we have the rural issues of where the healthcare workforce is located and if we can keep some of our own at home in the communities where we have these shortages. As part of the Academic Excellence and Economic Development Committee of the Board of Higher Education, I've had the opportunity to engage with many of the associations, industries, and other educational institutions in the state, recently talking about the barriers to increasing the workforce. And at all cases and at all times, it comes up of the cost of educating these skilled workers as well as our capacity currently. I won't go through all the barriers that we've looked at, but you will have a copy of this PowerPoint that you can review later on. As I talk about the partners in Oregon in the healthcare education workforce, we have acronyms, Chair Flores, which I'm hoping I have identified on this particular PowerPoint.
Very much appreciated.
AHEC, of course, is the Area Health Education Centers. ONLC, the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. OHCC, the Oregon Health Career Center. The OAHHS, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and our educational institutions, Oregon Health Sciences University, OIT, Oregon Institute of Technology, and many of the community colleges. I think out of our 17 community colleges, 14 of them have some type of allied health or health professions programs. So along with those organizations go many current initiatives in the state, some of which were legislated, as you can see, particularly through the Governor's Health Care Initiative, the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, Community Colleges Health Care Action Plan, the Oregon Rural Telecommunications Education Committee, and, of course, the State Board of Higher Education and Oregon Health Workforce Project under OHSU and OIT's Oregon Center for Health Professions. So you can see we do not lack in associations or colleges, universities that are very interested in this. But what I would like to do today is speak more in terms of what can we do together. I think the key is collaboration and coordination of these partnerships. If we look at what healthcare means to Oregon's economy, we know that it's a significant contributor. The healthcare industry is indeed an engine for economic growth, employing over 100,000 people, generating $4 billion annually, and the hospitals alone probably employ 40,000 of those with an annual payroll of over $1.8 billion. The average salaries of this workforce is about $48,000. Many of them have much higher salaries. And we're projecting the health occupations will be 11% of the job growth by 2012. I recently saw an article in Oregon Business that showed the healthcare ranking number 3 in the growth of jobs in the next few years. So definitely a significant economic impactor. And if you look at the impact of shortage on the economy, if you reverse it, the shortage is driving up the healthcare costs and can be hampering economic recovery in the state. As we looked at some of the data from some of the hospitals, we found that some of the healthcare costs at individual hospitals, and we looked at only two, one small hospital and one larger one, just for an example, that they were spending between $1.5 and $3 million annually for finding agency healthcare nurses. And that was not full-time employees, but what we call roving nurses. It was costing them that much. In the field of radiology, they weren't using so much the agency radiologists to supplant what they needed for workforce, but they were actually having to pay 1.5 times what would be the average cost to their workers due to overtime pay because of lack of the opportunity to hire them full-time. This is true throughout the state, and this particular problem is growing. As we began our work on looking at the overall education and health care issues, we were partnering with several associations to see what is a true needs survey. And currently, Denise is working with the Oregon Hospital Association and the governor's healthcare workforce in order to update the needs the hospital industry needs in the state so that we can collaborate and get this as up to date as we can. What about OIT's role in this? We have a concept called the Center for Health Professions, which encompasses all of our allied health programs, and we share a nursing program with Oregon Health Sciences University on our campus. We have currently 750 students in allied health and expect to double that by 2010 if resources are available. The sad part of this story is we do not lack for the pipeline of students. We're currently turning away over 300 qualified students each year because of lack of capacity. As we look at our allied health programs at OIT, you can see that all of these programs are inclusive of the definition of allied health: radiology, nuclear med, sonography, vascular, dental hygiene, a bachelor's degree in health sciences, which transfers into a program in medical, as an MD program, or also veterinarian. We have laboratory sciences, and we have emergency medical technology for a current enrollment of 763 students. What do we want to do with the Center for Health Professions? Create a premier center of excellence within the Pacific Northwest by developing partnerships with community colleges and the health industry, and participate forcibly in the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Initiative. To do this, we are launching a fundraising campaign for $22.5 million from private and public sources. We want to build on a mission and tradition of excellence. We had a nursing program which began in 1971 and continues as a partner with Oregon Health Sciences University. We have the oldest radiology program in the state, began in 1952, and dental hygiene in 1969. And as we have built upon these programs, the additional ones we have added, you can see as follows. We have been very instrumental in helping with the nursing expansion in the region of our state in partnership with Merle West and assisting Oregon Health Sciences University to expand that capacity. We also have helped the continuing education and professional development needs by offering bachelor's degree completion programs web-based in radiology, sonography, echocardiology, dental hygiene, and respiratory care. The increased demand in all of our majors is growing, and we have had to cap that demand the last several years. Where are our students going to continue their education? We have existing outreach in externship locations throughout the Pacific Northwest, on the East Coast, and in the South, and are currently developing the middle section of the United States with extern training sites. These students particularly spend one full year on the job in experiential learning at these extern sites. Where are they in Oregon, throughout the state, in all the larger cities, as well as in the rural cities throughout our state? We know that education and training is the most important reason for worker shortages, according to the Oregon Healthcare Sector Initiative. And as we have already said, employment opportunities not only in Oregon, but throughout the nation are tremendous and growing from U.S. Bureau of Labor and Industry data. Although Oregon Institute of Technology has a total enrollment of just over 3,300 students, half of our student populations are in the allied health areas. And their graduate number may seem small in terms of the tremendous workforce need. Our goal is to double, though, our graduates in 5 years by enhancing the capacity on the front end. How will we make an impact statewide? Through partnerships and outreach throughout the state, enhanced distance education, expanded web-based delivery, and most recently, with the help of the Oregon Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative, we will begin to develop simulation education in outreach regions throughout the state. OIT has exemplified what it means to partner in serving this allied health need. Beginning this fall at LeGrand, in collaboration with Eastern Oregon University and the Oregon Dental Association, we have implemented a dental hygiene program in LeGrand. ODS is currently building a laboratory facility, and beginning in the fall, we will have our first class of dental hygiene students located in Eastern Oregon. We are very proud of that three-way partnership. Another example is this fall we implemented a respiratory care program at Rogue Community College in Medford. That program had existed initially as a two-year degree at Rogue, and with their invitation, it was not a takeover. We went over and began a collaborative program with them where we now manage the respiratory care on their campus and also have expanded that into a four-year degree opportunity. What is the secret and key and prescription for Oregon in terms of allied health education? Alliances and partnerships, both public and private, with hospitals, with clinics, with the equipment manufacturers and vendors, with research alliances, and with community colleges that provide the basic programs that we can expand and help in delivering a four-year degree. Many of our ongoing partnerships that we are in dialogue with exist all over the state. We are having discussions with Clackamas Community College. We share a facility already called the Metro Center in Clackamas, and we are talking about building together the opportunity for a healthcare cluster in the Clackamas region in partnership with the key hospitals and industries there. One very interesting tweak that OIT can provide in the healthcare industry is the fact that we also have programs in engineering, computer hardware, software, manufacturing, mechanical, that we feel will build an integrated health industry high-tech merger to make a difference in the ever-evolving high-tech imaging and equipment that is needed in this healthcare diagnostic area. We know very well that with merging high-tech with the evolution of healthcare instrumentation, that we will have a very unique opportunity. We are helping in some of our healthcare cluster work to bring in manufacturers and to bring in high-tech industries that are continuing to evolve the instrumentation for the future. This is part of our vision. We know we can provide the workforce development in initial education, degree completion, applied research, and outreach, including on-site and distance delivery with key partners. As we look at our partners, we talk about what do we each provide. We can find more access for our students through sharing scholarships, to developing scholarships with the industries, through sponsorships, facility shared programs, as well as enhancement for capacity, equipment donations, and opportunities to form consortiums for discounted purchasing of very costly equipment. And this is very important. The cost of educating in allied health is very high because it's hands-on, it's applications applied to being able to do the skills that they talk about, and it's also the cost of one-on-one teaching. The student-faculty ratios required for allied health programs are much lower than some programs. Our partners can support for us faculty positions, shared facilities, clinical experiences, and information technology. We think we have a model that can create a strong foundation between education, the healthcare industry, and manufacturers. The expansive breadth of programs leverages OIT's unique strength in applied service and research. We can provide a regional nucleus for undergraduate and allied health education. And I might mention, you may have read that Clark College and Washington State University, just across the river, are talking about expansion in health. We feel we should be able to do this in Oregon. And so I'm here today to also bring that to your attention. We cannot delay. We must move forward with a statewide initiative in this area. We will launch a fundraising drive. We are going to be doing many proposals with partners, many of our community college partners, as well as industry. And we know this is going to require a robust telecommunications infrastructure. We are also wanting to partner with the Telecommunications Task Force in Oregon in order to make this true. We have a vision for a new center in Klamath Falls to expand our capacity, badly needed, and this will be through potential private and state resources. At this time, we do not have any budget bills in for that center. I do want to make that very clear. I am not here asking for your money at this time. But our goals are to develop an educational consortium for allied health, to expand capacity, to maximize efficiencies and resources, and develop educational programs to meet the need for health professions in healthcare information systems, as well as the didactics for the allied health professions. We want to ensure that the telecommunications capacity around the state is operational and affordable to efficiently deliver programs in both rural and urban areas. And more than anything, we expect to double the number of graduates in allied health programs to make a significant impact on the healthcare workforce. So in closure, I would say the initiatives are increased enrollment, enhanced facilities, expanding and elevating outreach, and the key to all is partnerships for a center for health professions. I'm very pleased that the audience today includes many young students who are potentially new members of the allied health workforce. Thank you.
Thank you, President Gao. And as you were going through your presentation, I was thinking the same thing. So I was hopeful that they were resonating and directing some folks' interest. You referred to this development of the health care centers in Clackamas County. And if I'm not mistaken, I think significant, there are two that are under consideration, and they're both in my district. So
yes.
I'm
yes.
pretty excited about that.
Yes.
When you talk about the statewide initiative, does that require more coordination from the healthcare partners or some legislative direction or input?
I think Representative Florin and members of the committee, I believe that we will be presenting a bill. I believe Representative Garrard is going to do that. That at least designates the Oregon Center for Health Professions in order that we can help facilitate the collaboration and coordination. At this time, that's I know what we're aware of. And also, Denise is serving on the Governor's Oregon Healthcare Workforce, as well as a member of the healthcare costs policy piece of the Oregon Business Council. And Denise, I'm probably not getting all these words quite right. Denise has recently come to us after a 25-year career in Kaiser Permanente. And so we feel that the connection with the industry and our connections with our allied health education partners can make a very meaningful difference in coordinating this initiative in the state.
Are there any questions for President Dow, Representative Dalton?
Just recently, OHSU dropped its rural nursing program. In this presentation, I see a lot of opportunities to pick that up. Is there a plan to pick up that program from us?
Vice Chair Dahlem and members of the committee, I believe that the recent indication that we have from Oregon Health Sciences University is that they will intend to maintain their nursing programs. They will have to do that, however, if there are no additional state funds forthcoming through rising tuition for those students. We host their program on our campus, and we're very anxious to continue to do that and to support that. So we are partnering with local hospitals there, of course, to get their support to enhance that nursing program. In our center that we're visioning in at the main campus in Klamath Falls, we would also propose to include the nursing in there. And they are a very key partner for us in the nursing area.
More specifically, I've had several students from John Day contact me with great concern, and my statement has been that even if discontinued, the program would feather out and take care of those presently enrolled. Is that true?
Of course.
Thank you.
But as of this time, there's every indication from OHSU that they will continue all those regional programs. They have a very strong Oregon Nursing Consortium where the community colleges and OHSU are building out a four-year program that's seamless from the ADN through the four-year degree. I think it's a very good program. We would see that being possible in the other allied health curricula so that we could have a seamless track from the two-year curricula through the four-year. Right now, OIT is the only four-year public institution with the allied health. And when we define allied health, we don't include nursing. We say nursing and allied health.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Representative Shields?
Representative March, would you?
Go ahead.
Okay.
I'll go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that seems to happen in the nursing field, and my wife's a nurse and a family nurse practitioner that she's mentioned, is that when particularly to enhance minority recruitment, that if people begin to pursue, say, an associate's degree in nursing or the bachelor's of science in nursing, and then for whatever reason, maybe personal circumstances don't allow them to go all the way to the end, that they would have some type of profession that they could fall back on. Mm-hmm. Is there something within your program that might allow that to happen? So let's say you got 2 years or a year and a half into an associate's degree in nursing, that you could still have something, it wouldn't help you for not.
Yes, and I think, Representative Shields, I'm I'm not an expert in the nursing area, but I know that the CNA program, the Certified Nursing Assistant program, is very strong. Several community colleges have that, and they can, you know, go directly to work. The community colleges right now also have the associate degree, and you can go directly to work. And the way the new nursing consortium is set up, that it is going to have a curriculum that would be very definitely aligned to completing the baccalaureate degree. And I think that's a very wonderful career path to, way to do that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Dow, the you mentioned the state bonding, and mm-hmm. you're not looking for that at this in this
no.
session. That would be sort of like next session.
Well, I think Representative March and members of the committee, we had hopes at one time that that could be a bond possibility, but we know that that's not very likely. So we are pursuing right now as much private support as we can, and to see how far we can get, and maybe in the future we would want to have more state support for that.
Okay, so you'd turn down the state money if we offered it.
I'm smiling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Dow, for presentation. And it seems to me half of the students enrolled in the area of nursing and medical technology, whatever. I envisioned OIT as the highly the engineering mm-hmm. and the scientist, something like the Texas Institute of Technology or even any others. But it seems to me the directions of this OIT going into more nursing in the medical field, mm-hmm. is that the, are we departing from the main objective of engineering? Well, what is the explanation
no,
of it?
Absolutely not. I think Oregon Institute of Technology, which it isn't widely known, Representative Lim, I know, has been in the health technologies from the very beginning. I mean, our radiology goes back to the 1940s, late 40s. I think we were birthed in 47, and radiology was part of that initial curriculum. But we have been better known, I think, statewide. We're best kept secret in the allied health areas. In some areas, we have always had the allied health. We had our nursing program come up in 1954. Right now we have almost an equal mix as far as student population. Half of our student numbers are in allied health, the other half are in engineering technology and management. So we're pretty much equal in terms of the division. But we see a very unique opportunity right now in terms of merging the high tech engineering with the allied health, and we feel that will really give us a very unique niche.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank
for
you
a very
so much.
Interesting presentation. Now we're going to have, I think it's a continuation of a presentation. From the Oregon Department of Education, Dr. Burke, and it's going to be information about No Child Left Behind and adequate yearly progress.
With the indulgence of the chair, I'm going to have to make some technological switches here.
Technological timeout.
Imaging MRI, that is an engineering marvel.
Yes.
And so tying that technology together, that's what I have. Yeah.
Was that small plane taken off, one of the ones that nosedived this week?
I'll tell you a story about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Somebody's home built didn't quite make the full.
Oh, no. But maybe it's in between the pot and the tree. Is it 80? Someone to assist?
No. For some reason, when we set it up for the OIT presentation, it messed up a file. And so now it's not loading properly. So I may have to proceed without it. I'm trying to restart it and see what happens. It was working before the committee arrived. So.
Well, of course it was.
Perhaps using the gavel would help it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to delay the committee and any further. And I'm also aware that it's a pretty daunting challenge to try to go mid-afternoon on a Friday, especially after many of you have been in a variety of other meetings, and try to make interesting and informative discussion about No Child Left Behind and adequate yearly progress. But we will certainly try to do that. And, Madam Chair, let me first express my appreciation to you and to the committee for setting aside this time. I know we attempted to get into this at the beginning, and we weren't able to do that, so I appreciate the opportunity to come back and kind of pick up this conversation. You do have a copy of the slides that I was going to be using on the overhead. If I can do some technological work while I proceed here, we might be able to get both of these up simultaneously, but I don't want to delay any further. So we are here to talk about the No Child Left Behind Act. And as I stated at the beginning of the committee meeting, when we first talked about this, the purpose of the act is to ensure that all students have an equitable and fair opportunity to achieve, at a minimum, proficiency on state standards and state assessments. Now, that quote that you see in your handout from the Act is a significant one in that the Act, for the first time, made a couple of important changes. The expectation is that all kids, and the expectation is that it would be on state standards and state assessments. Those were significant changes in the law. There are some underlying principles in the Act. First, as I just mentioned, it is to expect success for every student. Also, that parental involvement and parental engagement is a very important part of this Act. The assumption is that schools can do better, not that schools are all in a failing category. The law does not make that assumption, but it does make an assumption that almost every school in America can do better, and that we should focus on results. There is a fundamental shift that has occurred, not just in No Child Left Behind, but as we've talked before, actually before this committee, and I'm sure in conversations that you've had elsewhere, the notion used to be that the outcomes of education were distributed basically under a bell curve, that we would standardize the input, which had been kind of the history of American public education, that especially in the post-war eras from the 1950s forward, an attempt to standardize what goes in, and even during a period of time where through remediation we would try to compensate what went in, but the outcomes of education were basically understood to be distributed under a bell curve, that there was an average and that some people would do a lot more and that some people would do significantly less, and that was not challenged very much until the mid-1980s. Publication of a document that received incredible international attention called A Nation at Risk, and that compared the outcomes of American public education to international outcomes. And long story short, I'm sure you're probably familiar with the document, that led to a lot of conversation nationwide during the first Bush administration, later during the Clinton administration, during the current administration, about what are the outcomes of American education? What do students know? What can they do? And can we begin to articulate that? So what I've showed you in that chart is the shift from an expectation of a bell curve more toward a set of standards, and that what needed to fluctuate were the inputs, that some students might need more to be able to get to the standard, and that the system itself needed to change around the idea of more universal outcomes, universal proficiency. So, No Child Left Behind, in terms of just some basic concepts, reauthorizes the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that was originally passed in 1965. I'm going to see if this will actually work. Well, what do you know? If all else fails, restart the machine and it works.
Get out first.
So. It reauthorizes the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. It was passed under the Johnson administration as part of the Great Society program. From the very beginning of the Act, funds were targeted to the needs of students who were poor and who had limited English proficiency. The funds are always to provide supplemental support for innovative programs, strategies, and technology. As I mentioned in my remarks before the committee earlier, key concept here is supplemental versus supplant. Supplanting, that is, removing general fund support and replacing it with federal dollars, is a violation of the law. Supplementing the general fund support is what is envisioned. So let me give you a hard case example. We have been promoting, as other districts as well, the use of all-day kindergarten or expanded early childhood education programs. It is permissible with the use of Title I dollars to supplement that half-time teacher, that 0.5 FTE in kindergarten. As you recall, under the funding formula, kindergarten students are reimbursed at half the weight. You can supplement that weight with federal dollars and make that an all-day kindergarten program. What you could not do is remove the 0.5 weight and replace that with the federal dollars. That would be supplanting. But extending the 0.5 by adding an additional 0.5, that's supplementing, and that type of strategy is allowable under federal law.
A couple of questions before you go on, and then I have one. Representative March?
Thank you. Dr. Burke, in the kindergarten money in specifically, is the amount we get from the federal government fixed, or is it, can we go, and if more schools decide to go to full day kindergarten, can we get more money?
Madam Chair, Representative March, unfortunately, we can't get more money. The funds are allocated both to the state and then through the state to the district based on poverty counts. Now, what is permissible, when those funds arrive at the district level, the district has some latitude. We're talking now specifically about Title I, and Madam Chair, we'll get to a description of those different sections. It is permissible for the district to target its Title I funds, so it could make the decision based on the allocation that it receives that it would put more money into kindergarten. It could make that decision as long as, and this we would need to stress as an important point, the school receiving the funds has to meet the poverty criteria to be eligible for Title I. But within that framework, there is that flexibility.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, no more money comes, but have the flexibility.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, I'm going to go back to, I think it's the second point. Is there a correlation, and do you have any information in our state, in Oregon, that would show a correlation between socioeconomic status and school performance? And I say this in light of the fact that we're hearing that middle-income and upper-income students are performing poorly in some of our schools. So what I'm asking is, do we have documentation or data that would support the notion that there is a correlation?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, absolutely. If I don't have the data here, I could log on to the Internet from here and I could show you the state data. There is absolutely a relationship between poverty and low performance. And in the national research, poverty is one of the strongest predictors of underperformance, even in some cases a stronger predictor than race or limited English proficiency. This is one of the reasons that the Act was originally passed way back in 1965, is to attempt to overcome the effects of poverty. That is not to say, and I've heard the same comments, we do know that there are students, for example, in talented and gifted programs who aren't achieving at a rate of growth that we would like to see. The difference is that for those students to even have been identified in a talented and gifted program, they are already performing in the top 3% nationally. So their aggregate performance, their average performance, is well above that of low-income students. So there's a certain relativity here. We want to continue to see students who are talented or who are already performing above standard to continue to grow. Now, I'm going to talk later today, so check me on this if I don't answer your question further. I'm going to be talking with you today about differences in the federal and the state accountability system about exactly this question. The state accountability system actually looks at schools' ability to keep students moving even after they have met standard. The federal system does not. So we're working to try to address that and to put these two systems a little bit closer together. So I will come back to that question later.
Thank you.
Dr. Burke, a question that I have, I guess, would be a little bit of a follow-up to that. It seems to me that I've seen some information that areas of high poverty and are specifically ethnocentric, not necessarily is it funding that has made a difference that has led to some very significant successes in learning and assessment, but it is the flexibility that schools are provided. Would that be accurate?
Madam Chair, that would be accurate. I just came from a delightful hour and a half where we are working to identify for public recognition. I believe I've mentioned this to this committee earlier for an event coming up in April. Schools that are effectively closing the achievement gap, and we have looked at these data from around the state. So actually reading these applications from schools who have remarkable data, I'm talking about very high poverty schools with high minority enrollments but are seeing high levels of achievement. One of the key variables that both of the national research and what we're seeing here in Oregon is leadership and flexibility. None of these schools are exactly alike. They take their resources, they do their planning, they engage their communities, and then they commit. I would probably say one of the things that's most critical is a sense of unity, purpose, and focus that the faculty generates around these issues. And when that happens, then they take their resources, like their supplemental federal dollars, and they're able to target it to implement that plan. So to... you've never really seen at the federal level a movement to do a one-size-fits-all instructional intervention, to say that every school has to teach this material in exactly the same way. So a certain amount of flexibility to local school needs and community needs, I think, is essential.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, and then I'll have another question. Go ahead.
Just following up to that, I wanted... to tell the committee and those attending for public record that one of those 20 schools happens to be Fairfield Elementary School in the Bethel District, where I worked for 3 years in special ed, and I'm very proud, and they're going to be one of the 6 schools that are applying for the finalist, which I guess will be the top school that that is recognized statewide.
So Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we were looking at their application today. You have every reason to be proud. It's a good school.
Thank you for letting me share that.
It's always great to tout success.
Yes.
That is very, very nice. My other comment, I think, and see if you can help me, perhaps, but by way of information, when we were talking about this is the No Child Left Behind basics, and we're indicating that this is a reauthorization of the elementary and secondary education Act 65, actually then what the... goes forward to list, yes, those are NCLB basics. However, they were actually brought into place in 1993 or 4 under Bill Clinton, and so they've been around for a while. It's not like they're brand new. We just, in the 2002 Act, which was a reauthorization of the older Act, had more accountability measures imposed.
Madam Chair, you're correct, but I will also add a few notes here. Yes, it is true that there were parts of the Act, frankly, have been around since the very beginning, since the mid-1960s. Title I, for example, was in the original legislation way back in 1965. What has happened each time the law has been reauthorized by Congress is that it has evolved and changed. And just to support what you just said, the requirement for a focus on state standards and state assessments actually was the version that came through the Clinton administration, was called the Improving America Schools Act, or IASA. During that reauthorization, all states were required to have a set of academic content standards and a set of assessments. And those assessments had to be approved by the U.S. Department of Education. The Oregon plan was the first plan in America to receive that approval from the U.S. Office of Education. The current version evolves that idea and says that those standards and those assessments, the results of that, instead of reporting just on Title I students, those results now must be reported on all students in all schools. And what was added was the idea of establishing a threshold target between 2002 and 2014 for all students to reach proficiency. Those two things were new in the current version. So it wasn't what I've seen over the years. I in the 30 years I've been involved with these programs, every school where I was a principal had Title I funds, and we were always seeing some new wrinkle in the law, some addition or change. Some of the things were very basic and they remain the same. So rather than it being a radical departure, I think the law just continues to evolve over time. There is another reauthorization halfway through that period of time from 2002 to 2014. This law has to be reauthorized again in 2007. So I'm assuming that there will be additional changes in the law by that time.
Representative Dolan.
In the, and I'm going to go back to 2000 and Title I, and didn't we have to do at that time a pre-test and a post-test, and I believe the selection of testing instrument was left to the school, and the student had to make progress in the Title I?
Yeah, Representative Dolan, you're correct. It was what had been in the older form of assessment and accountability was a concept that I'm sure you're familiar with. It was called normal curve equivalence, or NCEs. And that was a separate set of tests, and the states were to identify, actually in many cases up to a local district to identify which test it was going to use. And then all of that data was converted on a statistical table to this thing called normal curve equivalence. And Title I programs had to report progress in normal curve equivalence. The new law addressed that in a very different way. Back up one step. The use of the NCE was in order to compare state to state, so you could have some common ground to look at our schools and states making progress. The new law changed that by requiring all states to implement the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP. So there was still a need in the law for comparability. I think I said the title before I used the acronym, I hope.
It was a nice save, though.
Okay.
I'll give you that one this time.
Federal law is acronym city, so we'll try to...
I know.
And you're in the streets and alleys.
All states are required to administer the National Assessment of Educational Progress, so that gives the U.S. Department this standard to look at across every state.
And I want to back up just a little bit. What we moved from was an assessment, and we had to have not the term adequate yearly progress, but Title I programs to show that. What happened to a Title I program if they didn't show that progress?
Madam Chair, Representative Dolan, that's an excellent question. I happened to be in that boat several times as a principal. The consequences for not making appropriate progress were to revise and submit a new plan, a plan of correction, to the Department of Education. And if the school was in severe need, even under the old legislation, IASA, there were funds for comprehensive school reform grants. Now, in the 2000 date that you are using, the criteria in use in the state of Oregon were the results on the state report card. So if you were low or unsatisfactory and a Title I school, you were required to submit a plan of correction. And that plan of correction was eligible for what were called comprehensive school reform grants, which would give some resources to low-performing schools to address their professional development needs.
Yeah. And that was the end of the. That's what happened to a school. What would happen if they continued down that trail and did not improve?
Under the old law, they would continue to be required to submit a plan of correction.
So it was submit a plan, move through a year, submit a plan.
Correct. And the department was in charge under the law to provide technical assistance. We were a much larger department at the time, and we would have staff people that would go out to schools and districts and do staff training and professional development.
How many schools had to submit plans more than 2 years in a row? And I'm going somewhere with this, Dr. Burke. Where I'm going is what happens now. Right. I want to compare the two is where I'm going.
I'm going to talk a little bit more about the data in a little while. Number of schools, let me compare the state report card this year and the AYP report. The state report card this year identified 37 schools in the state as low or unsatisfactory. The adequate yearly progress calculation identified about 356, as I recall, schools not making adequate yearly progress. Of that number, about a third of those schools were Title I schools, and the consequences only apply to schools that receive Title I resources. So of the 356, approximately 110 to 120 of them are engaged in the process. I have the list of schools, which I'd be happy to leave with the administrator. Could show you the list of the schools and districts.
If those schools don't make progress year after year, what happens?
Well, I'm going to walk you through that in a little while. There's 5 years of consequences that we'll walk you through.
Thank you.
Make sure you come back to me if I don't answer your question.
Thank you.
I need to correct, by the way, it says $481 million. This is a slightly older figure. As you know, the President's fiscal 06 budget was released earlier this week, as well as some of these funds actually are distributed and rolled out over a 27-month period of time. The total number actually fluctuates a little bit from the first half and second half of the biennium. That number actually is closer to about $460 million for the biennium, at least in their estimates right now. It's still obviously a significant amount of money to the state.
What was that last year, Madam Chairman?
Ms. Representative Dahlem.
What I'm trying to do is track where the federal government is taking us. Is that up or down?
It's up in some areas and down in others. Let me be specific. Title I, which is the largest part, 4 years ago was at about $79 million that grew to $98 million. It was $131 million about 2 years ago, and it currently sits at about $136 million. So Title I has gone up. Other parts of the program have actually been either cut or eliminated. But the total number, Representative Dahlem, is an increase. We are, frankly, a little bit more concerned. I'm sure you've been seeing this in the press all week. These funds have increased to states annually over the past, two decades that I'm familiar with, assuming maybe even forever. That is not true in the President's fiscal 06 proposal. There's actually a 1% decline in these funds. That's the first time we've seen a decline. But I've been through this several times with Congress. I would treat that, and we're treating it as a department right now, as a starting point. This is the President's proposed budget. I guess this is going to go through a lot of changes before we get to the bottom line. But the reason it got all the press attention is this is really the first time that there was a proposed reduction in these funds nationwide. I've talked a little bit about the Oregon context already, that we had had a report card in place and still do. We had aligned standards and assessments, and we had an approved assessment system. Our state board, and I talked about this at our earlier meeting, has adopted 6 performance objectives related to No Child Left Behind. And then, as I mentioned, the law is divided into sections. And with the indulgence of the committee, I'm going to save the conversation on Title I until the end. It's by far the more complex and where I'm sure you will have questions. So let me switch then quickly to Title II, or the second chapter of the law. And it has to do with professional development, recruitment, training, placement of teachers. States, and Madam Chair, for the pot, state education agencies in federal law are typically referred to as SEAs, and local education agencies are referred to as LEAs. Those are school districts. So when you see the term SEA, that refers to the Oregon Department of Education. LEA is a local school district. Local school districts have to develop plans to have what the law calls highly qualified teachers teaching core academic subjects. This is a new part of the law in this version. They have to be in place by the 2005-06 school year, and paraprofessionals or educational assistants must have at least 2 years of college or an associate degree and pass an assessment in math, reading, and writing, and they must speak English. This has, I'm sure, come to your attention. I would be surprised if any of your constituents, either superintendents, principals, or the public, has not brought this to your attention. This is one of the more controversial parts of the law. 100% of classes in core academic subjects are to be taught by highly qualified teachers, and this is all teachers in all schools, not just schools that receive Title I funds. So what is a highly qualified teacher according to the law? On the surface, it seems fairly straightforward. They have to have a bachelor's degree, they have to have full state certification, and they have to have demonstrated subject matter competence in the area that they are teaching. Now, on the surface, that seems reasonable, but I would, for example, use a rural district, small school, high school, with a limited student population and a faculty that might not have all of the areas of certification that you would want to see. For example, I could be licensed as a physics teacher and be teaching two sections of mathematics. Now, if I don't have full state licensure in mathematics, and this school would receive Title I resources, I am now subject to the penalties in the law for having a non-highly qualified teacher teaching in those two courses. And that's where the controversy has come. Those letters have gone out for the past 2 years. They generate a lot of consternation, and I'm sure they've probably come to your attention as well.
Dr. Burke, those are the requirements of a highly qualified teacher under No Child Left Behind.
That is correct.
What are the requirements for under the Oregon model?
Madam Chair, the second bullet talks about full state certification. The administrative rules around full state certification are about the size of the New York City phone book. There are a number of rules related to how you get full state certification in the state of Oregon. The federal law didn't stipulate a specific requirement for certification. What it said was that you had to meet your state's requirement. So in the example that I used about high school, the teacher with a license in Oregon would have a degree in mathematics, would have had a minimum of a bachelor's degree in mathematics, would have passed the praxis examination, the content examination in mathematics, had achieved entry into an Oregon graduate school for their teacher preparation program, and successfully completed that program and received a teaching license. That would be a full state certification in mathematics. Now, if I assign that teacher to teach science, so they are not fully certified in science, the current administrative rule allows that teacher to, the term is called misassignment. You can misassign a teacher under Oregon rules for up to two instructional periods, or less than half of their instructional day, without them being required to submit a plan of correction. Under the federal law, that teacher who is teaching outside of their area of license is considered non-highly qualified for those classes. It's a confusing part of the regulation. I'll be happy to go through it again if I wasn't clear.
Is there some state provision for a master's, a requirement for a master's?
First of all, I would urge you to talk with Vicki Chamberlain of Teacher Standards and Practices. She's the director of that commission. The continuing license, there is not a requirement for a master's degree in the initial license. The continuing license has received a lot of attention on whether or not a master's degree would be required to achieve the continuing license in Oregon. Right now, I don't think it is, but that is that's an issue that the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission has been debating for the past year.
I believe
Representative Dahl.
We did ask her that question, and I believe she explained to us that we were preparing the best qualified cadre of teachers in the nation, and that's my note. I hope that's correct. Right. And that we would have Title I qualified teachers, and we do have programs in place. But I'm going to ask Dr. Burke, is this a question of pedagogy where one organization would, or one level assumes that we teach a teacher, and once you learn to teach, you can teach anything? And the other pedagogical philosophy is that you teach a teacher, and then you teach them their discipline very well. Does that seem to be the mix or the...
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think you've stated it very well. You have your finger on the issue. There are two points of view, I would say, in the literature. One is that effective teachers have strong preparation in content knowledge. In other words, if I'm a math teacher, I have a strong background in mathematics. And if I have that strong background in mathematics and I'm licensed to teach mathematics, I shouldn't assume that I would be an equally effective English teacher. That's one point of view. Okay? And that if I'm looking for effective English teachers, I should insist that they be licensed to be English teachers, since the requirements to get an English license are different than to get a mathematics license. That's one of the reasons that in Oregon, the bachelor's degree in the content area is a requirement. So you're correct about Oregon's reputation. The fact that Oregon has that requirement puts it among some of the highest state standards in the United States. There was a recent study by the National Council on Teacher Quality, NCTQ, and they ranked Colorado as an A, and then there were six states that were given B's on their system, and Oregon was one of those six. California was given an F, for example, by comparison.
The point being that, and I want to make this crystal clear and on the record, we have generally some of the best teachers in the nation.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I would certainly agree with that, and there's national objective data to support that. That's one of the areas of confusion and some frustration about the federal legislation, in that the requirement to say that this teacher is not highly qualified when a teacher has achieved Oregon State certification, that the citizens of the state are getting good teachers in that process.
Then I want to back up a step. Highly qualified teachers, in No Child Left Behind, and I'm going to get to me. Highly qualified teachers design the standards that we expect students to perform to. They design those standards. And that's our very first statement here, is that Title I students must meet state standards and state assessments. And I'm going back to our last meeting when you told us that we designed our own standards, and we being our teachers. Is that correct?
The federal law requires each state to design its own standards.
And we've done that with our highly qualified teachers.
We have.
And then we were to design our own assessments, and our teachers were involved with that.
They were.
And yet, we're failing to meet the mark. Is there something wrong with this formula?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I'm not sure what you mean by failing to meet the mark. If you mean student achievement, we can talk about that, or are you referring to teachers not being highly qualified?
I'm talking about student achievement with non-Title I classes. I'll wait, because I think you're going to take us to how we perform in in Title I schools. I think you can take us there, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay. Then I'll ask about this teacher preparation.
May I insert a question here?
Of course.
Thank you. Now, the subject matter competency requirement of No Child Left Behind for a teacher. In your example, you used a mathematics major who has a subject matter competency in mathematics. However, you use them in another classroom, and so they are, what was your term?
The term in Oregon rule, it's called misassignment.
Misassignment. Mm-hmm. Okay. However, with the flexibility of some of the funding stream from into the Title II program for professional development, cannot those funds be used to help bring that teacher to a subject matter competency?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. One of the things that I was just checking my slides, see if I had that in there. I must have taken it out in the interest of time. Title II, we're talking here about Title II. This is a very, very flexible part of the federal law. These funds, Title II funds, are about $28 million on an annual basis that are distributed to schools. And I would want to say, by the way, by federal law, 95% of that money in Title II must go directly to school districts. So these are not funds that are held in the department. These are out in the schools. They are intentionally flexible to allow districts to do exactly what you've talked about. I'll give you an example. Beaverton was seeing an interest in improving the math performance at the middle school level, and they surveyed their teachers and found that they had a lot of teachers teaching in middle school that had elementary licenses but did not have specific in-depth training in mathematics. They used their Title II dollars to do a year-long mathematics institute for middle school teachers, and at the end of that institute, the teachers were able to achieve a math endorsement on their license, and they used Title II dollars to pay for that. It's a very creative way of using the money on an identified need and then improving the professional capacity of their teachers.
Representative
Bell. Wasn't this the example used in the federal legislation to explain why money was to be more flexible because math teachers with elementary endorsements did not have a math background? And so this creativity was really the genesis of why we wanted to train teachers.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, that is true. And, for example, one of the areas, both in the state data and at the national level, we've been talking about this before this committee, is that secondary school literacy, as just if you were to look at data, and what is the reading and writing ability of high school students, is lagging behind other areas. So what we've seen are more, I was just meeting with superintendent yesterday who was talking to me about how he intended to use his Title II dollars to expand the professional development for high school teachers to include literacy across the curriculum. Teacher Standards and Practices is now going to be requiring, beginning in June, evidence for a secondary license, a high school license, evidence of the teacher's ability to teach literacy in the secondary classroom. Those are examples of how Title II funds can be targeted to identified needs in the data, and we need that flexibility. And Madam Chair, let me also say one thing about Title II. It does have one additional option which lets districts use Title II dollars to lower class size. They can, if they choose, use Title II dollars to add additional teachers at the elementary level, particularly in grades 1, 2, and 3, if they choose to. So there's considerable flexibility in Title II.
Thank you. I'm trying not to hold you up, and yet those things just come up.
Not a problem. This is a complex law, and I'm happy to answer those questions. Let me move ahead a little bit in the interest of time. These data reflect the last 2 years of results in Oregon on that highly qualified teacher data. So let me just point out one thing right here. We're looking at the most recent data in the first column, 2003-04, and comparing it to the year prior in 2002-03. Overall, And I think this speaks to the level of quality that Representative Dahlin was talking about. 89% of the classes taught in Oregon schools are taught by highly qualified teachers, teachers who meet these criteria. If we look at that in a self-contained, this would be essentially elementary classrooms where the students are with the teacher all day. Notice that the number rises to 97%. That's a very high number. When you see here are the numbers by content area, this reflects either at a middle school level or at the high school level the problem that I was just describing. Especially in a small school or a rural school, you might have more teachers that are assigned more than one teaching assignment. You'll also notice that in high poverty schools, the numbers are lower. This is consistent with the national research. It is more difficult to maintain highly qualified teachers in high-need schools. There's more teacher turnover in those schools. Now, the good news in Oregon, if I go out here to the difference column, even in the high-poverty schools, you'll notice that we're seeing increases in the numbers of teachers from 2002-03 to 2003-04. So we're moving in the right direction, even in the low-income schools. With the flexibility of Title II to focus professional development, we'll be able to, I think, make even more progress. You've Dr. heard... I'm sorry.
I think Representative March wanted to shoot one.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you could get back, if the national data, I'd be interested in seeing what the national data, how that compares to Oregon when you get if you get a chance.
Madam Chair, Representative March, I will certainly try. I have to tell you that these are... This is truly apples, oranges, and grapefruit when you talk about how this gets compared on a state-to-state basis.
Fruit salad.
It's been very difficult to get comparable data across the states, but okay. I will certainly try to get that.
Or maybe a couple of states that you think are comparable.
And Dr. Burke, is that not because each state has its own standards by which they are approved, and yet that means they're achieving at some level? And I realize that when you say apples to oranges to grapefruit, it means because no other state has exactly our set of standards, but every state has its own set of approved standards.
That's correct.
To measure some success or level of achievement.
Madam Chair, the data that are on the chart here are the data for teachers who meet that highly qualified teacher definition, and you're absolutely correct in your analysis. Because every state has its own criteria for issuing a teaching license, comparing A to B to C means you're comparing three different procedures for issuing a license, and therein lies the problem. The reason that Oregon is ranked high is because of its insistence on demonstrated competence in subject matter. Some states don't do that. So you have a situation where you could have more teachers in these numbers in another state who are identified as being highly qualified, and in fact they are not nearly as qualified as Oregon teachers might be.
And yet, Dr. Burke, does that not mean that each state is using its locally prescribed determining factors to determine their
Absolutely.
Yes. Local outcomes, and Representative Dahlin's just anxious to spit one out.
Yeah, I would just say, Madam Chair, that one of the hallmarks of this legislation, this was very controversial. It took 2 years of debate in Congress to get the current version, and a real sticking point, and I think I mentioned this in my prior comments to the committee, was whether or not this was about national standards and national criteria or local standards and local criteria. And the debate ultimately came down on the side of local standards and local criteria, and that to move toward national teaching licensing or national standards or national assessments was perceived by Congress to be too much of an infusion into local state control, and ultimately the policy was to expect every state to establish its own standards and its own procedures.
A point of clarification. When state standards were defined, some states built their own standards. Others relied on a national norming process or a neighboring state norming process. So we do have some states that have similar standards.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, not that I am aware of. States that tried to adopt other state standards had those plans turned down by the U.S. Department of Education because they hadn't established them through their own state procedures. So it was not possible to simply say, oh, well, I like California standards, so we'll just adopt theirs.
Then, and with teachers, isn't there, I know NCATE works, but there is a leveling approach because we have a, I get $12 in it. Because we do have a,
13 now.
At the teacher college level, we do have a norming agency that at least requires a minimum standard for teacher preparation.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, the National Council for...
Thank you.
And he won't get it.
Academic teacher certification. Stay with me.
It's college, National Association of Colleges of Teacher Education. It's NCATE. And they do have a set of standards, and I'm pleased to say that Oregon has a very active chapter, the Oregon Council for Teacher Education. They do consistently look at national performance indicators for high-quality teacher preparation programs. The difference here, I would say, is that all of that is voluntary. There is no national requirement for a teaching license, with the possible exception of the there is a set of national professional teaching standards, and there is a process that you can submit to. It's totally voluntary. It's very expensive, and it takes about a year for a teacher to go through it. But they can receive what's called national board certification. But the numbers of teachers that do that is very small. There was additional flexibility in the law for rural schools. We have continued to advocate for more flexibility, and there were at least three areas that additional flexibility were allowed. Rural schools have additional time for teachers to become highly qualified. Science teachers now can use a broad field science rather than their individual field of science. And there is more flexibility around multi-subject teachers. This was particularly helpful at middle school level, where we had many teachers who were teaching in middle school on an elementary license rather than a high school license. Switch now to Title III. Title III are programs for limited English proficient students. It requires that the teacher teaching in those programs be certified and also be proficient in English, and it provides some discretion over the instructional program. And there's a wide variety of programs students for whom English is a second language. The major change here is that every state was required to establish what are called English language proficiencies. I have to make a distinction here between the English language proficiencies and the state's English standards. I'm talking about two different things. The English language proficiencies were for students for whom English was a second language, and the states were required to set standards for what language acquisition would look like. And then to have target goals, they're called annual measurable achievement objectives, for students to make progress toward English language acquisition. And the funds in Title III, and over the next biennium, it's going to be a little over $10 million distributed to school districts, was designed to improve the programs in limited English proficiency. Title IV deals mostly with school climate and creating positive, healthy, and safe school environments. There are two major parts of Title IV, the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Program. That's about $6 million, a little more, $6.7 million in the coming biennium, to promote school safety programs, anti-bullying programs, creating safe, healthy environments for children. anti-drug programs. Oregon, as you know, has a very strong and active anti-drug community. And the 21st Century Learning Community Program is a new part of the law and one that is, I think, proving to be very successful. A 21st Century Learning Community Center is an after-school program that extends the school day, and the federal law provides funding for districts to develop proposals to expand their day and to also operate summer school programs and, in some cases, even Saturday schools. The funds made a distinction earlier between categorical distribution and competitive distribution. This is an example of a competitive process. Districts have to develop applications. They submit those applications to the department. There's a panel review of those applications, and grants are awarded. And we expect to offer about $10 million a year over the next 2 years of federal funds for these programs. I would say that this is one area of the law that has proven to be very popular because of the clear evidence of the importance of good after-school programs for kids. Title V has to do with innovative programs. This too, as I mentioned earlier, some areas are more flexible than others. Title V provides funding for innovative strategies. It's not a lot of money. It's only about $4.5 million over the biennium, so about $2 million a year. But it does provide local districts an opportunity to experiment or to innovate or to try new ideas. It also contained in Title V is the public Charter School Assistance Fund. That fund is going to be at about $10 million over the next biennium, over the next 2 years. That, too, is an area where there have been a lot of applications, a lot of interest in the process.
Dr. Birkin, as you are giving us these figures, you are giving us the figures that flow into Oregon.
Madam Chair, thank you. Those are Oregon dollars, yes. And they're biennial dollars, and I have to put, I wish I could really nail this down, but we really won't know about the second half of the biennium until we get a firm budget out of the U.S. Department of Education. And that might take another several months or longer before we know for sure what the budget's going to look like. Title VI is flexibility and accountability. This is where the support for the statewide accountability system is. Over the coming biennium, that will be around $11 million for the continuing evolution of the accountability system. As I mentioned earlier, science has to be added. And when we get to Title I, the current state assessment system looks at benchmark years at grades 3, 5, and 8. The new federal law requires that by 2007, all grades from 3rd grade through 8th grade would be part of that accountability system. So we have to develop and add tests in grades 4, 6, and 7. So part of the funding that comes in under No Child Left Behind is when the federal government increases the expectation for accountability and assessment, the law has also provided resources to states to develop and implement that requirement. This part of the law also has funds that are called the Rural and Small School Initiative. There are about 22 districts in the state that are eligible for these funds. It's about $3.8 million over the coming biennium. And I would point out that this is an example of a categorical distribution. These are pure flow-through dollars. They come to the state, and the state just turns around and pushes the money out the door to the eligible districts. The state does not keep any of the administrative cost or overhead of these funds. These are flow-through to local districts.
Okay. Representative Dahlman?
What's the definition of rural and the definition of small?
Definition of rural is in federal law. I'd have to get the law and quote it to you exactly. It has to do with schools that are isolated. So they have to be at a minimum 20 miles from the nearest school, and they have to be at a certain student population. So, it could, for example, it can't be a real big rural school. that wouldn't be small.
Do you have any idea what that CERT population is? Do you have any idea what that CERT and about on that population?
I would be guessing and pulling it out of my head. I'd rather not do that. I'd be happy to get you the figure out of the law. We also have on our website, Representative Dahlem, all of the districts that receive those funds. There's a variety of information on how these funds are distributed to those districts. Title VII is Indian Education. Indian Education funds in Title VII provide district coordinators to eligible districts. The number of students are controlled by whether or not they are registered as with a recognized federal tribe or federally recognized tribe. Provides instructional materials and student and family support. I put Title VII in here, even though you won't find it in our budget. Title VII funds go directly to school districts. You won't find a reference in our ways and means material to Title VII. Those go to the eligible districts. And then the final three are relatively minor parts of the act. Impact aid is a very small amount of money, less than $1 million over the coming biennium, mostly for students who come as refugees from other countries and have a high impact on certain districts. Title IX are the legal definitions, and Title X is the McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Act. The homeless funds for the coming biennium are about $1.3 million, and they go to districts that have high percentages of homeless children.
Dr. Burke, before you move ahead, what do you have a recollection of what the Title VII funds are that are distributed directly to the eligible districts?
I do, Madam Chair. In the last year, it was about $2.4 million, so approximately $5 million over the coming biennium. But that's a little tricky for me because we don't necessarily get those budgets. They go directly to the eligible school districts. But it's about $2.5 million a year.
There are certain categories, as I'm tracking with you, that may flow directly to school districts rather than go through Department of Education. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what is also interesting in the new regulations is the recipients of funds have also changed. For example, I'm sure you've seen this in the press and in other conversations about the law. There's much more flexibility in funds going to private nonprofit providers, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations. For example, the requirement for, and we'll talk about this when we get to Title I, in providing supplemental services to students who are not meeting standard, the law specifically prohibits the school that failed adequate yearly progress to be the provider of the supplemental services. Supplemental services have to be provided by another provider, and in many cases that's a private nonprofit or a faith-based organization. That's a substantial change from the old law. There's a lot more flexibility on who can receive the funds.
The slide prior on under Title VI, you'd indicated that there was a categorical distribution for the rural small schools.
That's correct.
And it was a flow-through. How is that distinguished from distributed directly to the school district when it's a flow-through you don't retain with no...
Madam Chair, it's a wonderful question. I don't know if I've got a good answer for you. Those are the federal regulations, and the Indian education distribution process has always been directly to school districts. To be honest, I don't know if I can give you a rationale on why the difference, but the funds don't come through us.
And that's prescribed by the law, then?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Title I. This is the more complex part of the law. Not that all the rest of this was easy. Title I, and so I'll be able to move through some of this fairly quickly because we have talked about this throughout the afternoon. Have to establish a set of standards and assessments, have to have an accountability system, have to show a plan where students are going to make proficiency until they reach that ultimate target by 2014. and the state is required to identify rewards and consequences. The assessment requirements have evolved over time. The law was passed in January 8, 2002. And so from 2002 to 2005, states were required to have testing at least once in grades 3 through 5, 6 through 9, and 10 through 12. Oregon met that prior to the law. Beginning in 2005, the annual yearly testing has to go every year, third grade through eighth grade. We're working on those assessments now, and they will go into effect in the 2005-06 school year. Beginning in 2007, science must be added. Oregon has already developed a science assessment, and it is already in place. And then the state is required to identify additional indicators. However, the federal government identified for us what one of the additional indicators would have to be. So graduation rate at the secondary school level is one of the additional indicators, and in Oregon the other indicator is student attendance. Now, the reason for this is that the accountability system, they wanted to look at things other than just the test score, to look at other indicators. But this is where, as the chair has already highlighted several times, when you start doing this on a state-by-state basis, it becomes very difficult to find a common additional indicator because the data vary so much from state to state, and indeed from school to school. The state then is required in its plan to develop a process of measuring the new current buzz term in education, adequate yearly progress, or AYP, and I'm sure you've heard the term. That simply means that the students had met the progress targets in this trajectory from 2002 to 2012 along a line that would move toward 100% proficiency on the state standards. 95% of all students must be assessed, and what is a significant difference between federal law and state law is that the federal law requires that the results of that assessment must be presented by subgroup, including students who are economically disadvantaged, all major ethnic and cultural groups, whether or not they are an English language learner, and whether or not the student has a disability. What is most controversial about the law, and which has received a lot of attention, is that those AYP targets, those adequate yearly progress targets, must be achieved by each subgroup, not just the average, which is what the Oregon State Report Card looks at. The annual adequate yearly progress report looks at each subgroup. And the law requires that that information be publicly reported on all schools. The current, and up until this year, the initial threshold for the first 3 years of the law was 40% meeting or exceeding. That threshold, and remember, this has to stair step or escalate toward 2012, so for the next 3 years, the threshold is 50% meeting or exceeding standard. There is an additional way that a school can make adequate yearly progress. It is called safe harbor, and what that means is that even if you have not met that 50% threshold, if the number of students not meeting standard has been reduced by 10%, then the subgroup is considered making adequate yearly progress. Now, back to Representative Dollum's question about, so what happens? What are the consequences, and how does that play out? If a school does not make adequate yearly progress in the first year, they're on notice, but there are no mandatory consequences. They just get the data, and they know that there is a concern. And we have some data to show that that works, actually. In the first round, we had about 144 Title I schools that had not made adequate yearly progress. Of that number, in the second year, about 60 of those schools had made adequate yearly progress. And as a result, only about 44 of those schools went into year two. So there was some indication that by targeting the need, putting the school on notice, they were able to target their resources and make improvements.
Dr. Burke? Excuse me, I'm sorry, but in regard to the timeline for the determining the improvement level, is that yet not another factor that is within the state purview to determine what you want to establish it at? In other words, every state can determine what rate of increase they're going to overlay?
Madam Chair, every state had to write a plan and to submit a plan. There, on another presentation, it would take too long today. There were 10 guiding principles from the U.S. Department of Education, and each state had to address each of those 10 principles and design its plan.
And I noticed then Oregon is increasing 10% per year.
That's correct. And we actually took advantage of some flexibility in the law. It was our view that a one-year target followed the next year by an escalation of the target was in many ways unfair to schools. We established three-year targets in the front part of the law. By that I mean the first years of the law, to allow districts to do the planning and to put in place a school improvement plan and to begin moving students forward. As a principal, it might take me a year to work with my community and my teachers in improving my school improvement plan, so you just get to a point where somebody is ready to put it in place and you move the goalposts. So we decided not to do that. What we did is establish these three-year steps, step increases. So it will be 50% for the next 3 years. What we could not do is leave it at 40% for 11 years and then say, okay, in year 12 we go to 100%. There were some states that actually tried to do things like that. When those plans were submitted, they were rejected by the U.S. Department of Education. There had to be a reasonable increase in student performance over that 12-year period of time.
Or is the term they use is trajectory?
Trajectory, that's correct. If a school fails adequate yearly progress for two consecutive years, they go into what's called school improvement status. And the law requires that any of the students attending a school like that, a school in school improvement status, if it receives Title I dollars, big if there, if it receives Title I dollars, the students in that school must be offered an opportunity to transfer from that school to another school that did make adequate yearly progress. So the first consequence is choice. If they failed adequate yearly progress 3 years in a row, they must continue to offer choice and offer what are called supplemental services. These are after-school programs, weekend programs, evening programs, providing tutoring and other support to students. And just going back to the chair's earlier question, these services are provided by a variety of providers. They have to submit an application to us. They go on an approved list of supplemental service providers, and it is the parent's choice. And this is, again, a significant change in the law. Parents can pick which supplemental service provider off of the approved list they want for their child, and the district pays for those services out of its Title I dollars. In the past, again, going back to Representative Dahlem's question about didn't we used to do something like this, the answer was yes, but what would happen is that those would be perhaps after-school programs that were run by the same school. You might hire a teacher for some extra hours after school to provide extra tutoring. In this case, supplemental services are the parent's choice and are usually from a variety of providers. I expect to see those numbers of providers actually to increase over the next couple of years. The fourth year is called corrective action, and that is where there is more mandatory intervention on the part of the state. The school is required to submit a formal plan of correction. We provide additional technical assistance to them, and that can include a major overhaul of their curriculum, mandatory staff development for teachers. I'll give you an example. If it turns out for four consecutive years the limited English proficient program in a school is not achieving standard and not showing growth, but we see in reviewing their plan that there has been no consistent professional development to help teachers teach limited English proficient students, we will order them then to address that in their plan of correction. the fifth consecutive year of not meeting adequate yearly progress is called restructuring. This is the most drastic part of intervention. The state is given a wide variety of authority, but there, I have to caution us that it says that it must be consistent with state law. So there are some matters of rule here that still need to be worked out. But for example, the law authorizes the school to be run by the state. The local district can turn the school over to the state. There can be changes in personnel, either at the district level or the school level, or changes in curriculum and instruction. So Representative Dolan, the answer to your question is that these interventions are laid out in the law as a gradually increasing level of severity of intervention. And the idea is to, I think, keep the focus more on school improvement, early intervention, and not getting to this point of five or six consecutive years of not making progress. The funding for this, there's also, I think, been some confusion in the press about this. There are no new dollars here. Now, there are increases in Title I, as I mentioned earlier, but you don't get more money by failing. What happens is that the district is required to set aside 15% of its regular allocation to pay for these consequences. So, in fact, what they're doing is pulling money back and holding it and redirecting it. They don't get new money because they failed.
In their current budget climate, they hold an automatic 15% per biennium or at the point of restructuring?
No, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. Once they get to year two, if they're going to offer choice, for example, if they're going to be required to offer choice, paying for the transportation to move students from one school to another, that's an example of what would come out of that 15% set aside.
What is the consequence to a school district when they don't meet the annual yearly progress higher up on the scale?
Let me go through that next. District improvement.
Okay.
This works basically the same as school improvement. All of the data from all of the schools in a district then are totaled up at the district level, and the same criteria are applied. So for all of your district limited English proficient students, or all of your district Latino students, or all of your district special education students, the same criteria apply, that 40% or 50% threshold. In the first 2 years, if a district has failed adequate yearly progress, and we just recently reported those figures, and you probably saw it in the press, there are 14 districts that we identified this year in the state for not making adequate yearly progress. They have to submit a plan of correction, Madam Chair, similar to what happens under the school improvement planning for a school. The district has to submit a revised plan of correction. They have to do that, and we are obligated, the state is obligated, to provide technical assistance to them. They also become eligible for they can apply for comprehensive school reform grants that we administer so that they can have resources for their plan. If, however, they go into year three corrective action, just like for a school, there is additional intervention by the department. We would continue to have to provide professional development and technical assistance to the district. The department is authorized to withhold either programmatic funds or administrative funds until an acceptable plan of correction is developed. We have additional authority, but again, this potentially comes into possible conflict with Oregon law and administrative rule to actually take over the operation of the district. We've asked the Attorney General for a ruling on that, or not a ruling, excuse me, but at least an opinion on that, because our concern is that that authority under the federal law may in fact conflict with Oregon law. In Oregon law, the authority to operate a local school district is delegated to local school boards, not to the state. So we're concerned that there could be some, and just looking down the road, we could have some policy conflict, and we're trying to resolve that.
A technical mechanism.
Yes.
I understand from your comment in the media regarding the schools that are on notice and in some course of correction that you see this as punitive.
Yes.
On the other hand, if they are required to improve every year, could it not be an incentive?
Yes. That is, Madam Chair, that's certainly the assumption in the law, and it's and actually one that I must say I think I support because I've seen data right here in Oregon that that seems to work, that when you have good data, you show that your areas where you're not being successful and you hold people accountable for improving in those areas and can provide some additional resources to help them with that, in fact, we have seen schools improve. And I think this highlighting of need for improvement can drive change. Where people feel it is punitive is that there is considerable debate about the accountability system itself, particularly the number of ways that a school can or a district cannot make adequate yearly progress. I started to put in your handout and then decided against it. I'll be happy to provide it to you. I have a flow chart that looks more like an electronic schematic that actually takes you through the process. Maybe it's sufficient to say that there are 60 ways that a school could not make adequate yearly progress. This is what's called a conjunctive model, and that's, Madam Chair, why people are sometimes referring to it as punitive. What it means is if you fail one part of the model, you fail the whole thing. So you look at performance by all students, then by African-American students, and by Latino students, and you go through that. There are 9 different categories, then by special education category, then by poverty. And if you do that throughout all of the English language arts standards, and then you do the same thing through the math standards. So if you add all of that up, there are 60 points in there where a school could be identified as not making progress. So the balance in policy that we're trying to reach here and why we are paying attention to this so much as an agency is to have to work on the accountability system so it makes sense to people, it's seen as fair and accurate and non-punitive, but also gives us the disaggregated data and the targets that we need for the resource allocation decisions and the professional development decisions. So it's this particular part of the law is probably one of the areas that is most difficult. I would say that if I'm a school or a district that has made adequate yearly progress, I'm fine with that sometimes. If I'm a school or a district that did not make adequate yearly progress and I end up with my school name in the newspaper, I'm not okay with it. And that's where some of the controversy has been.
And perhaps that would be the driver to change.
Yes, yes.
Representative Farr.
I just wanted to point out for the committee that the Bethel School District, which I represent, had several of their schools that did not meet adequate yearly progress. And those schools took that to task. They accepted the challenge, and the following year all of the schools that did not meet adequate yearly progress met or exceeded adequate yearly progress. And just for the committee, I would like to share with you Fairfield, which is 75% free and reduced. The state average for the Hispanic population in grade 3 reading and literature is 63%. They increased to 85%. Economically disadvantaged, state average 73, they were 91. Special ed, state average 52, they were 87. That's in reading and literature. In grade 3 mathematics, Hispanic 100% at Fairfield, the state average 63. 98% economically disadvantaged, state average 72, and 86 to 57 in special ed. So it's really quite amazing what that school did.
Yes.
Very economically disadvantaged, but those teachers and that administration decided that they were going to work very hard to meet adequate yearly progress, and
incented to do so by virtue of the
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, that is one of the reasons that we're engaged in the work that we are doing now. We want to highlight that success. We want to document not only that a school was successful, but what did you do? How did you achieve that? Make that information more available to other schools in the state. We are absolutely committed to the idea that we can close the achievement gap, and it does require leadership, as you've just described, and it also requires know-how. What works, and we need to identify that and make it more available to others.
Well, I hope that the Bethel, I'm sorry, may I follow up, Madam Chair? I hope that the Bethel School District is used as a model because almost all of their schools met or exceeded. Four of the schools were exceptional, Clear Lake, Danabo, Fairfield, and Irving Elementary, and AYP improvement was seen at Cascade and Shasta Middle Schools, and then, of course, Fairfield is one of the 20 schools recognized statewide as closing the achievement gap. And I just want to point out to the committee that this is in a severely economically disadvantaged district. If you compared it to Eugene 4J,
yes.
It's it's a very different makeup of the student population.
We have consistently, Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we have consistently tried to, in our technical improvement activities across the state, continue to build the idea that identifying local capacity, putting people in touch with other people who have success, and what you have just described in a very eloquent fashion is at the core of all of this. A lot of this starts with leadership and vision. It's saying, we can do this. It's going to be hard. It's going to require making tough choices. We're going to have to realign our resources, but we can and will do it. Without that first step of leadership, almost everything else is impossible, and it requires that type of focus as a first step, and that district has done that.
Well, that just a follow up to that. Then the leadership you're suggesting would come from the district level, or the state level.
Madam Chair, I'm hoping that we are seen as leaders. I think we also get attacked sometimes as being the hammer that comes down in this accountability system. But our purpose here is to establish clear accountability for you as decision makers and for the public. The accountability system has to be clear. We have to publish the data, and it has to be accurate, and it has to be something that you can take to the bank. But then the question is, okay, now if we know the condition of the schools, what do we do about it? And then promoting good practice, identifying successful strategies, working on leadership. I've had a chance to talk with you a little bit previously about the State Action for Educational Leadership Project, the SELP project that actually Eugene 4J some of the folks in Bethel have been a part of, where you begin to develop the leadership capacities among superintendents, principals, and teachers to address this issue. This is hard work. This is different work than we've done before, and it does take that kind of commitment from leadership.
We have 14 schools that have been identified as not making adequate early progress. I think what we want to watch is when we get to the end of 6 years, where those schools are, and my statement would be reconstitution. I'm going to look at this from a parent's perspective and a student's perspective. It's 6 years to get things changed around. I don't think there's anything we can. 6 years is a long time. And to wait for all of that to happen and not have anything happen engenders very little sympathy.
Yes.
If you're reconstituted, perhaps leadership was absent. We'll all probably know what was absent, but it will not be the end of the world if a school is reconstituted.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I, in my life prior to coming to the Department of Education as Deputy Superintendent, I was part of the process to make that call on two schools. Probably in my professional career, two of the hardest decisions I was ever a part of. To actually say this school must stop operating the way it is and it's going to be rebuilt from the ground up. Our experience with that was that even in making that drastic a change, and I'm talking about the dismissal of all teachers in a school and saying we are going to reconstitute this staff starting from scratch, from the principal's office on down, what the reality was is that that decision alone is not sufficient to turn a school around. It requires additional focus over multiple years after that decision. One elementary school that I'm thinking of actually turned staff over about three times before the new principal actually got the team together. As Representative Farr was talking about, you've got to have a team that shares a vision. They're on the same page, and they're committed to what you're trying to do. That doesn't happen just because you reconstitute a school. That requires consistent vision and leadership over time. And so I am cautious about saying, even in a process of escalating intervention, that if you get out to restructuring, you'll finally fix it. I don't believe that. I think school improvement is a continuous process, an evolving process that requires sustained leadership over time.
As part of the problem in that effort to bring a school to excellence, and perhaps through reconstitution, are there some contractual hindrances to making that happen in the leadership, in the district, the school, bringing the team together? There are some contractual issues.
There are some, yes. And for example, if you are, there's a difference between reconstituting, where you are in effect reassigning all of the teachers in a particular school, as opposed to dismissal, which is obviously a contractual issue. There are contractual issues around mandatory professional development. And if I have a new instructional strategy that I want all of my teachers in my district to achieve, can I make them do that? For future reference of the committee, a superintendent who is currently engaged in that in, I think, a very effective way with his union is Jerry Colonna in the Beaverton Public Schools. They've just completed a five-year professional development plan in collaboration with his union that is totally focused on literacy and getting all kids to these standards. It's a very impressive piece of work. And there are issues with his collective bargaining agreement, but by sitting down and working those out, they were able to resolve them.
Thank you. Representative Lynn.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Burke. In your presentation, you mentioned that how do we compromise federal mandate, the state control it when the school fails.
Yes.
And at the same time, our state law provides that the local board has to do we have any plan to how to compromise that?
We do. Madam Chair, Representative Lynn, thank you for the question. And let me jump to that, because, Madam Chair, I appreciate your committee's indulgence. I know that we're past time. If you would like, I can answer Representative Lynn's question. The issue, Representative Lim, is that both the state report card, as you see on this slide, and the adequate yearly progress plan actually look at the criteria look at the same criteria. They look at participation rates, performance, behavior, measures of improvement, and an overall rating. The problem is that they look at it somewhat differently. They use different types of data. So the short answer to your question, what we are currently working on, is to blend these two systems so that there isn't that conflict of policy between the federal system and the state system. Let me give you an example. The Oregon report card looks at participation in actually three different ways: 95% or above, 85 to 95%, and below 85%. So there are three different measures of participation. The federal law establishes one basic participation rate. It must be 95%, and it's got to be 95% of the entire student population. So that leads to confusion between, well, was it participation at the state level or in the federal level? We're trying to do is work on the formula that would integrate this and resolve these conflicts. The one that is probably the most difficult is the one around improvement. This is an area where we think the Oregon system is actually superior to the federal system. We currently have a very, I think, clear formula. It's complex to describe, but basically what it does is it looks at 4 years of data in a school, and it takes the two oldest years and the two most recent years, averages them, and then calculates the difference, and then looks at whether or not the school is continuing to improve over that four-year period of time. Part of that calculation is based not only on whether students met standard, but actually for students who had already met standard, did they continue to grow? So how many students exceeded standard? So it looks at growth over time. The federal system does not do that. We think whether or not a school is improving over time is an important thing to measure. So we're working on a formula that would put this together. Now, we are doing this with consultation with the U.S. Department of Education. This will require, in some cases, approval by the department to change our plan. But going back to Representative Farr's question, we have consistently said our focus here is to develop a better system, not to let people off the hook or to lower our standards, but to be more transparent and more accurate and more fair. And I believe some of you have met Donna Foxley, the Secretary's representative here in the Northwest region. Donna and I meet, we talk almost weekly on the phone, and we meet monthly. Donna's become a good friend and ally, and we have kept the department informed at all steps along the way of what we're trying to do.
I'd like to make a one comment, Madam Chair.
Representative.
Concerning the especially Title I program, when the school and the student do not have the criteria, then they are getting some Title I funds. But and with the continued pressure, they try to hope to improve. But what we are letting out, the student doing well, we don't reward them anymore. And so it seems to me we should have some kind of a mechanism in this Title I program, reward the student school doing better, so continue to encourage it. Only we are putting more money into the Title I, those are students who couldn't make it.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, you are absolutely correct, and this goes way back to my opening remarks about the law. When the law was first passed in 1965, it was about poverty and low performance and limited English proficiency, and it continues to have that focus, and you're right. Madam Chair, I would only point out one additional thing based on what we have been talking about. If I provided in your handout where you can get additional information, if you were to log on to our website, as I am doing now, you get to this page where data is available. I would point out just a couple of quick things, if I could. This will only take about a minute. The data is available in either English or Spanish. The data are available for any district in the state of Oregon. You can scroll through and pick a district. I'd be happy to open a district if anybody wants to take a look at it. I've been talking about Beaverton, so I'll open the Beaverton district. Now, what is available on this site is the report card data that we have been talking about, the district report card from 2000 through the most recent data, plus the district adequate yearly progress report, and then for each school in a district, the same data, the report card data as well as the adequate yearly progress report. The one thing that is slightly different on the school data, you'll see this other indicator called the report card detail sheet. Those are the numbers in the report card formula. It's actually a detailed analysis of how the report card is calculated. So if we were interested, for example, in the district adequate yearly progress report for Beaverton Public Schools, this is what it would look like. Me.
blow this up in a more readable fashion. So you could flow through it and see all of the schools for a particular school district, whether they met or did not meet adequate yearly progress. And then there's information throughout on the numbers of the calculations. For example, this is participation rate for the district, and I've talked about how you calculate participation rate. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee. There is a great deal of data on the website by going to this part of our website, looking at both the report card data and the adequate yearly progress data on every school in the state.
Very quickly, the participation rate, that means that not every student is tested. Is that correct?
The objective of the law is to test every student. There is an area of exemption in it's called whether or not the student has a severe cognitive disability. And that can be up to 1% of the total student enrollment. So there is some flexibility in terms of those students. But the objective, Madam Chair, is to assess every student. There are some assessments that qualify for participation but wouldn't necessarily qualify for achievement of the state standard. These are typically called alternative assessments to alternative standards. They're typically used with students with disabilities. But even in the area of students with disabilities, Oregon has developed a variety of alternative methods of assessing students with disabilities to the state standard. So there really, in our view, are very few students that we would have to totally exempt from the state assessment system. Oregon statute does allow a parent for religious reasons to request an exemption from the state assessment. That's the only allowable exemption under Oregon rule.
Thank you very much for your forbearance and even skipping through a few of your slides, unfortunately. However, I just noted with Jim that on the current issues slide, I think that is subject for a separate and whole presentation on accountability formula and public confusion, consequences tied only to Title I schools, and comparison of the state report card.
Madam Chair, absolutely. Those are the areas that we are currently wrestling with,
yes.
And they are, back to Representative Lim's question, how do we put these two systems together in a way that makes sense to people?
So we'd like to have that presentation.
I would be delighted.
Thank you very much. Thank you for staying with us, and thank you, committee, for staying with us and seeing that there is no other business. You're excused.